In this episode of Think for Christ, I'm joined by philosophers and authors Daniel Vecchio and Pat Flynn, who are here to talk about their paper in which they contend that there cannot, in principle, be a successful logical problem of evil formulated against the classical view of God. Dr. Daniel Vecchio holds a PhD in philosophy from Marquette University and has been teaching at colleges and universities around the country since 2007. Pat Flynn is a frequent guest to the show and is the proprietor of the Journal of Absolute Truth over at Substack and the YouTube channel Philosophy for the People. Links to their paper and links to their work will be provided in the description of this video. Pat, Daniel, thanks for joining me today on Think for Christ.
Great to be back, Anthony. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, let's talk about evil. You guys have recently published a paper in New Blackfriars on the topic where you make the case that the logical problem of evil is stone cold dead and cannot in principle be resurrected as an argument against God, at least not against a philosophically robust view of God, such as one finds in classical theism. So I'd like to start off with a question regarding the scope of your paper. The problem of evil, as you know, is a massive subject in the philosophy of religion that can actually get really complicated. There are different kinds of evil that we can talk about. We can talk about natural evils, moral evils. There's different kinds of arguments that can be formulated. There's logical versions, there's evidentialist versions, and there's different strategies for responding to the problem. So here we can consider defenses versus theodicies. So could you guys situate what you're doing here in the broader landscape that is the problem of evil as it's found in the philosophy of religion?
Yeah, sure. I'll take the first whack at it, I suppose. So somebody recently asked, you know, hey, why are you guys even bothering with the logical problem of evil? Isn't it already dead? And, you know, the story people commonly hear is something like this. Yeah, the logical problem of evil was chugging along, and it seemed to have a lot of force for, you know, a lot of philosophers until some intelligent chap named Alvin Plantinga came along, and he beat it up, right, with his sort of famous or infamous, depending on how you see it, free will defense. And there's actually some truth to that narrative. Daniel and I did a little historical research there, and, you know, even, you know, your kind of sophisticated atheist philosophers like Mackey seemed to make a concession to Plantinga. He said maybe his account isn't, like, super satisfying overall, but it does seem to really be a problem for certain proponents of the logical problem of evil. But that isn't the whole truth. I mean, the story didn't stop there. You know, if you look at the professional literature, the problem of evil, the logical form, which, by the way, is trying to show that there's, like, a strict incompatibility between God and negative states of affairs. It's a very strong, like, you can get a contradiction, you know, out of between the two. And we'll talk in more detail about how one tries to fetch that contradiction out. But it's not dead. It's still discussed, and it's sort of come, you know, a little bit more seriously back on the scene in recent years. You know, there's a philosopher named James Sturba, who's got a whole book on this issue, and then there was another volume of all sorts of philosophers kind of going back and forth on it. So it's very much still discussed. Maybe it doesn't receive as much attention as these other forms of the problem evil, but it's not totally dead. So what we want to do was address kind of two different parties, right? There's the sort of skeptic who thinks that they have a successful logical argument for evil, and we want to show why that's not the case. We also want to address the sort of optimistic atheist or skeptic. And there's a contingent of thinkers out there, we cite at least one prominent one in our paper, who say something like this: okay, I can't give you a formulation of the logical argument for evil that I think is currently successful, but I'm hopeful that someday we might have one, right? We have to be patient, right? And keep working at it. And what we want to do is we want to say, no, this is something that actually, it can never be successful. And to sort of set expectations about what our project is doing is we're not offering a theodicy, we're not offering a defense. What we're showing, all we're showing, is that the ingredients you need for a successful logical argument from evil, namely a certain moral linking principle, we'll talk about that going forward, are in principle epistemically inaccessible. It's not the sort of thing that from our position we could ever know whether it's true. And for that reason, a logical argument for evil can, in principle, never be successfully run. So it's a different sort of project, and but we think it's an important one. Why? Well, from some of my other work, which we've discussed on your podcast, mm-hmm. like the work I've done in cosmological reasoning, I think you actually can give a very logically strong argument for God. From very, I think, modest and defensible assumptions, you can fetch out a contradiction just from affirming the existence of a very simple everyday facts. And we discussed that before. So if there's a good logical argument for God, and there's no good logical argument against God, a classical theism, I think that's philosophically significant. So that's sort of the broad overview. I'm sure I'm leaving out a few details. So Daniel, if you wouldn't mind, fill some in. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I did think it's important to kind of explain the difference between what we're doing and a theodicy, where a theodicy almost takes the argument at face value and then tries to rebut a premise by showing, well, actually, God is not incompatible with negative states of affairs or evil in some sort of, by offering some possible justifying, morally justifying reason that God might have. We're not really offering a morally justifying reason. Instead, we're reminding everyone, including the atheologian, as I would term him or her, that God, the burden is on them to substantiate their premise. And in particular, it's going to be, as Pat said, this linking premise that they have to formulate in some way that makes it such that God is somehow related to evil, such that God would seek to eliminate it completely. And so we're trying to say, you need to substantiate that point. And it seems, according to our analysis, any attempt to do so is going to be futile.
Yeah, good. And even more specifically, it's either going to come out as just wrong on inductive grounds or question begging. That's sort of what we're ultimately aiming at. Sorry for all like the initial qualifications, but this is
no, I think
we've learned
good.
Of like talking about this online, like it's a weird sort of argument. So like we have to do a lot of expectations management. Like it's not an argument by analogy at all. People seem to get that initial impression.
Yeah.
So if you read it that way, you're not going to get it, but I guess we should just proceed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think it's good to see what you guys are doing because you're doing something unique. You're not like you said, you're not offering a theodicy. You're not trying to justify God in light of a problem of evil. And you're also not doing what Plantica calls a defense, because their Plantica has these propositions that seem mutually incoherent. And what he does is he adds a proposition, right? Mm-hmm. That is, makes the whole statement coherent because this proposition jives with everything else yep. in the argument. Whereas you guys, you're just shifting the burden of proof. You're saying, hang on, unless you're going to give us in order to give us a logical problem of evil, you've got to justify, you've got to give us some warrant for the linking principle that you're using. So it is kind of a unique approach, and I really appreciated that. So you spend some time in the paper explaining the nature of the logical problem of evil as an internal critique of theism. So what do you mean by this? And why is this important to keep in mind in the context of this debate?
Yeah, good. So just real quick, you know, a logical argument of evil has, and we state this at the beginning of the paper, it really has kind of three particular kinds of premises. It's got a datum premise, which would be pointing towards negative states of affairs, evil, right? It has what we might call a characterization premise, which is just, it specifies our understanding of God. And then it has what we call a linking premise, and this is the critical one. And the linking premise is it's usually a moral principle that's supposed to enable the inference, ultimately, of attributing failure to a perfect being, right? And it's in that idea that you get a sort of a contradictory result. So that's just people can just keep that in mind as we move forward. With respect to the idea of an internal critique, yeah, this is important because what's going on here might be best illustrated by looking at a sort of common cartoon sort of response that theists sometimes give to atheists when faced with the problem of evil. And it goes something like this: hey, joke's on you, skeptic, because to even talk meaningfully about evil, you need to already be committed to theism and the existence of God. So it looks like the problem of evil is actually a problem for you, buddy, not me. And this is a really bad response for several reasons. I mean, first off, you know, like, it just sort of assumes that, like, moral realism or something can only fly on theism. Cards on the table, I actually think that's true, but for a lot different reasons than you'll hear on most popular level moral arguments or apologetics. But we won't get into that. The bigger point that's being missed is that the problem of evil is being issued as an internal critique. So it's entirely irrelevant what the atheist believes. The atheist could be a moral nihilist for all intents and purposes, because what they're saying is, like, look, you as a theist, you have your soup of commitments, and it's in your soup of commitments that I'm showing you they're actually contradictory. So this is a problem for you and only you. It's not a problem for me. Unless, like, you're cool with just holding absurd contradictory positions, you need to figure this out to show yourself and the world that it's your worldview, your picture, that isn't just exploding or imploding entirely in and of itself. So the reason that's important is that, you know, that it's true that the theist sort of has to show, I think, that their position is not, minimally is not contradictory, right? It might have various other tensions or paradoxes, but minimally it's not contradictory. But it works the other way too, insofar as, okay, if it's an internal critique for the theist, that means they only have to worry about their commitments. They don't have to play by commitments that the atheist holds, right? So if an atheist holds a completely different theory of axiology or moral theory, and they're trying to import those commitments to run a problem evil, the theist has every right to reject it, right? Like, hey, look, dude, I'm not like a hedonic utilitarian or something like that. So, like, if you've got a problem of evil with that in the mix, like, I don't have to pay any attention to that. Like, here's my axiology. Here's my moral theory. I have to play by these rules. I have to show you how I'm consistent with, unless you can show me, like, demonstrably that your alternative is true, which that's a tall order. So what I'm saying is it works both ways, right? The theist can't get out of the problem of evil by pointing to the atheist commitments, but neither can the atheist sort of run a problem of evil by importing commitments that the theist has every right to reject. So, yeah, Daniel, your thoughts now.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, or to remind our audience that our target is the logical problem of evil, which is cast as a sort of consistency argument where you have various propositions that involve theistic commitments, right? And so it's importing into it, can one hold that God is a perfect being, or a being that is omnipotent and morally perfect or something like that, with something like evil or negative states of affairs? So that implies that it is an internal question. Now, one could formulate the problem of evil in a way that's not an internal critique, it's sort of like a inference to the best explanation or something like that, where you're looking at evidence and saying, well, what best fits with the evidence that we have, something like that. And that's just not our target in this paper, although what we have to say might be relevant to that. You know, that's sort of speculative. But, you know, when you're doing a paper, you have to set your target. So our target is over the logical problem. And that makes it more focused on this sort of internal critique. And so we, in particular, are going to be looking at our conception of God, or our doctrine of God, and how that in particular is going to relate to this, because you can kind of have a generic theistic commitment, a kind of maximal being, whatever that means. But we are utilizing some of the key insights of classical theism.
Yeah.
In particular, this idea of grounding or causal dependence, the layering of reality, that we believe is very relevant in our critique of the argument. That is, if you're going to say the target's on classical theism, then your linking principle is going to have to take into account how we understand God's relationship to creation.
Right. And that means that the Christian who's responding, the classical theist, is going to be able to bring the features of their own philosophical theology to bear in response to this question. So let's talk about those features and commitments of classical theism that are being deployed in this paper.
Yeah, good. So real quick, we've talked a lot about moral linking principles. The one that we start off with, which, you know, finds inspiration in some of the literature and the problem of evil, just to give people an idea, is this, right? It goes, if one is in a position to prevent the suffering or sin of some other being without incurring some cost clearly worse, they should do so. Otherwise, they are morally at fault. So just keep that in the back of one's mind, because we'll return to that, and we'll sort of begin to test that principle within the theistic, classically theistic paradigm to see if it actually is something that is not just objective, right? And as in stance independent, but if it's absolute, right? And we're gonna say it's not, and I think we're gonna be able to show that there's clear cases where it's not absolute. But going back to the commitments of the classical theists, the ones one of the ones that is super important for our project, Daniel already hinted at it, is the sort of relation that God bears to the world. So classical theists are committed to an analogical notion of causation. God is a cause, yes, but he's not a cause like we are causes, or anything in the contingent order are causes. And the way that God relates to the world is in a relation of the way the world relates to God is in a relation of what we might call metaphysical dependence or deep dependence. And this is where the entire being of something and all of that thing's properties are entirely, immediately dependent upon the productive condition. And we do have some examples of this in the created world, even though it's not exactly like how God causes the world. But we have examples of metaphysical dependence. And in fact, metaphysical dependence or deep dependence is something it's quite discussed and defended in the metaphysical literature. What are some examples of this? One example would be us as beings capable of imagining things and the things that we imagine. So as we move along, we'll talk about the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien. So you imagine that Tolkien is actively imagining his Lord of the Rings story or narrative. You know, this is before he sets it down on paper or whatever. This is an example of deep dependence, because whatever is being imagined is immediately, we would say, synchronically dependent on the activity of the imagining mind, right? If somebody comes along and, you know, rudely, you know, knocks Tolkien unconscious, boom, there goes everything that is imagined, right? So we have this sort of deep dependence relation. There's other examples, too. They're less relevant to our paper, but you might think that a waltz is sort of metaphysically dependent or grounded upon in the movement of the people who are doing the waltzing. So it's a well-established notion apart from theological context, but for our purposes, it's just important to note that this is one of those internal commitments of the classical theist, that the world relates to God in a manner of metaphysical dependence, where all the being of the world, the real being of the world, everything in the world is immediately, efficiently, or productively caused by God. So, yeah, so that's one thing to keep in mind. Daniel, I'm sure you have something to add to it. Yep.
Well, going back to, and maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but I think this is an important, a couple of caveats that I wanted to set up. First, we're not saying that the dependence relationship just is one of imagining, or we're somehow a fiction in the mind of God. There are people who've gone in that direction in addressing the problem of evil, which we reference in our paper, but that's not really our project. We are committed to our own reality. We do think we exist in a robust sense, though not as robust as God, but certainly we're not fictions.
Sure.
So I just want to kind of lay that out, just because I know that that's probably one of the biggest points of confusion people have when they read our papers. Oh, they're saying we're like stories or fictional creatures. Yeah. Okay. And then second, going back to that linking principle that Pat formulated, we sometimes refer to that as a horizontal principle. And so that principle really doesn't involve the deep layers of dependence. And to that end, as a horizontal principle where I'm not dependent on, or rather, whoever I'm sort of encountering in the world is not dependent on me in that way, we would readily grant that we do have some sort of moral obligation to assist, say if it's at little cost or whatever, to render aid, to be a good Samaritan, as it were, if you see someone in trouble. We're not saying you don't have such an obligation. We endorse that kind of principle. The question is whether that principle then can be applied to God. And there we think this layering of reality becomes relevant, because we note that in other cases, like in Tolkien, when that layering is brought in, it no longer becomes apparent that Tolkien has that same responsibility. So Pat, I'll pass the baton that way.
Let's try and tie those threads together, and I think this will start to make a lot more sense. So here's something to keep in mind. When it comes to making inferences across layers of reality, where there's a relation to metaphysical dependence, we actually think there's a rule here, and we develop and defend this rule in the paper. It's called the rule of restricted inferences. And what we're essentially showing is that the sorts of inferences you can make, you know, based upon the features of a less fundamental reality to a more one, are actually very thin, right? And if that's the case, then it might be a problem for trying to make certain moral inferences. And ultimately, what we're going to show is actually this is a real problem for trying to make certain moral inferences. And the fact that the only way you'll be able to kind of even think you might be able to make this leap is just by effectively begging the question and restating the conclusion you hope to establish against God. So again, just sort of trying to show people where we're headed to keep expectations set. Yeah, sorry, Anthony.
Just to keep us moving along, just for the sake of time, let me see if I can get us right to the central claim that you guys are making in this paper, and then I'll just get out of your way so that you can build your case. Yep. And here, if you don't mind, I'll directly read from your paper. So you write this: our primary contention is this. The inferences that we legitimately make across layers of reality, for example, what we can infer about one layer of reality based on what occurs in another, are extremely limited, particularly in the moral realm. In fact, you write, we argue that no inference can be made about the moral status of God at the fundamental layer of reality based on negative states of affairs at less fundamental layers of reality. And you go on to say this blocks any possibility of running a successful logical argument from evil, because to make the argument work, the skeptic would have to assume either that God exists on the same level of reality as humans, an assumption classical theists emphatically reject, or introduce a linking premise in the argument that is question begging. All right, so that's your central claim.
Yep.
Go ahead and walk us through the argument.
Good. So first off, Who wrote that? Was that Shakespeare? It sounded like
that
pure poetry.
That was beautiful,
wasn't it? Sounded pure poetry to me. Okay,
some unnamed poet.
Yeah. So the rule of restricted inferences. This is a little technical sounding, but I don't think it's that complicated. It says this: hey, if A and B are realities such that A is less fundamental than B, and where A is metaphysically caused by B, then we can infer properties of B from A only under specific conditions. And here are the conditions. The first one is that it is logically impossible for A to have some feature F, whatever that is, if B does not have F. So an example of this would be the feature of existence, right? It's just impossible that the more fundamental reality lacks the feature of existence if it's actively causing the less. So we can make that inference. That's safe, right? If you think existence is a feature, and I think broadly it is, right? Or, this is the kind of more relevant one, inductive evidence supports that the feature F in A implies F and B based on other known independent examples. So you kind of build an inductive case. Okay. All right. So now what we need to do is we need to see if we can make sorts of moral inferences with the rule of restricted inferences in mind. Why? Because we have to make inferences across layers of reality, right? This is the relevant context if you're going to try to run a logical argument from evil against classical theism. And what we're going to show is by looking at examples or cases from an inductive perspective, is no, these principles break down. They violate the rule of restricted inferences. So I say that we're looking at examples we're not making an argument analogy because we're going to bring up Tolkien again. Everyone thinks we're making an argument analogy here. We're not, right? But Tolkien is an example where you have a narrative with lots of suffering. Beings suffer, right? Now, people will say, well, they're imaginary beings or fictional. I know. We'll address that in a minute, right? But they're beings nonetheless, right, of a certain status or mode. And if we go back to that original principle, Tolkien is clearly in a position to prevent the suffering or sin of any of the beings that he's actively imagining without some cost clearly worse. Now, somebody might actually quibble with that, but we'll just grant that there's no cost clearly worse. Yet he's not morally at fault. Nobody thinks that Tolkien is a degenerate or morally blameworthy or a failure for thinking up the entire narrative of Lord of the Rings, which, although it doesn't attend to all the grotesque features in a particularly pornographic way, which we address in the article in a later objection, clearly there's all sorts of grotesque evil in the Lord of the Rings, right? Tons of horror is going on there, right? But as soon as you try to take that principle and like apply it across layers of reality in this, it breaks down. And again, we're not saying that we're fictional beings or God's imagining us. We're saying here's an example of a deep dependence relation, of metaphysical dependence, with the rule-restricted inferences in play where we try to make a moral inference and it doesn't work, all right? So the inductive case is not off to a good start, starting out. Right. Let me pause there and let Daniel add some thoughts and we'll
Yeah, so it's sort of like this, you know, you turn to the inductive case, you see it doesn't work, you think, oh, it's not working, let me tighten up the principle so that it is more applicable to our circumstance. And so you tighten the sort of vice on the theist. And the issue is you get to a principle from there that is really sui generis. It's referring to the act of creation itself. So it's not an induction anymore. Now you're just talking about creation. And so this sort of final formulation of the principle really only picks out what? God creating reality, or a being who's causally dependent or the cause of some reality. And then the principle goes on to state that this being would have moral responsibilities to us. And the point is that itself just is the problem of evil. So you haven't really given us a reason to accept it. You've just sort of assumed the very thing you're going to prove. I sort of jumped the gun a little bit.
No, that's all right. Yeah, no. So I'll build on that. So what Daniel is saying is that once it's clear that that original formulation of the principle isn't going to be able to run the problem of evil, the skeptic will have to begin qualifying or amending the principle, right? So they could try and do this in different ways to try and get it to run across layers of reality, right? So they might say, well, okay, let's qualify it like this. If some being, which is the metaphysical cause of some other being, and thus at a different layer of reality, is in a position to prevent the suffering or sin of that being without incurring some cost clearly worse, they should do so, otherwise they're morally at fault. That amendment doesn't work because, again, it fails in a Tolkien example. He is a metaphysical cause. All right, so blah, blah, blah. Continue on, and then the most obvious adjustment to the principle, which we sort of preempted and which is we're actually trying to drive towards this, is to qualify over only real beings, right? Like, so get rid of the fictional or imaginary beings and amend the principle like this. If some being, which is the metaphysical cause of some other real being, not fictional or imaginary, is in a position to prevent the suffering or sin of that other real being without incurring some cost clearly worse, they should do so. Otherwise, they are morally at fault. And so now you think you've got a principle that might have some real bite. But the problem is now once we come back to the idea of an internal critique, well, there's two problems. One, your inductive case is gone because we have no other instances of this. But it's worse than that. Not only is your inductive case gone, but now what you have is there's only one possible instance of this restricted principle. And the only possible instance of it, as Daniel said, is just God in the world. Yeah. Because internal to classical theism, internal to that paradigm, only God can create real beings. Nobody else, nothing else can do this. So the restrictive principle is just the same as saying, if God is in a position to prevent the suffering or sin of some other real being without incurring some cost, you should clearly do so. But that's not a linking principle. That's what you're trying to prove. That's just a conclusion. So the problem is to get the linking principle relevant enough to affect the classical theist, it has to become flagrantly question begging at that point. And so what we're ultimately saying is, like, maybe that principle's true. We haven't shown you that it's false, just that we could never know that it's true, right? Only the being that's in that particular position would have epistemic access to that, which is God, right? So only God would know whether that principle is true. And then
and it's
kind
the
of like,
skeptic. It's the skeptic who bears the burden here, right? I mean, they have to show to us, they have to demonstrate how this linking principle applies vertically, how it can transverse the creator-creature divide, right? They have to show us that. They can't just state the conclusion, you know, and then say QED and walk away, right? They have to demonstrate why their principle works.
Yes, and right. Go ahead, Daniel. Yep, sorry.
And if you go back to the rule of restricted inference, we outlined there's really two avenues, right? So one is the inductive case. We close that off.
Yeah.
The inductive case just doesn't work with something so unique to God. There just isn't going to be any other examples. And then the other way would be to say somehow that it's logically necessary that somehow this moral obligation can be inferred. And we just don't see any case for that being made or could be made, because you're essentially, in effect, to say that kind of puts God back on the horizontal axis, saying, well, God's got moral obligations like we do.
Right.
Again, sort of logically necessary that he doesn't. Go ahead.
And that just begs the question against the classical theism. Again, the logical problem of evil, you have to take into account the philosophical theology of the theist that you're dealing with. And with the classical theists, we have this idea of God's radical transcendence, right? God is radically transcendent in his being. This is a point that Brian Davis points out in the books that he wrote on the problem of evil, that God is not a moral person with an ethical case to answer. But you guys are pushing it further, and you're saying, not only is God transcendent in his being, but he's also transcendent as an agent in his action, right? In his causality, there's metaphysical causality. And so we can't just take the relations that obtain between creatures on a creaturely level of reality and paste it onto God across layers of reality. We can't just paste what applies to creatures onto God, who exists who exists transcendently. We need some kind of a linking principle. And it's the job of the skeptic to give us that linking principle and to justify it. Tell us why it is warranted to take this linking principle and apply it across layers of reality, and that's their burden. Is that correct?
Yeah, somebody read the paper. Thank you.
Right. I think in the logical problem of evil, the theists often are too anxious to accept a lot of the principles without sitting back, relaxing, and saying, okay, well, make your case. You know, why is this sort of implication true? And I think when you actually sit back in that position, it is the Socratic position, after all, right? Why think this is true? Make your case. There's a certain anxiety, I think, in the theist to accept that there's some sort of principle there that they have to somehow rebut, and so they have to accept something like that there is a linking principle and then mitigate against it. And I think you can kind of relax and say, discharge your burden.
I like that. Because without a moral linking principle, there is no logical problem of evil.
Yeah, we certainly, yeah, if especially if you can't know whether that the relevant linking principle is true. And just it might be helpful again to just sort of contrast our approach even with Father Davis's approach, or even skeptical theism, because these are different projects. I don't want to say they're incompatible or they can't be harmonized. But we mentioned Father Davis at the beginning of our project because he's somebody who kind of takes advantage of the internal critique to his favor. He says, well, you know, hey, What's the story of morality and moral obligations for classical theists, right? Well, it's something like a traditional essentialist or natural law story, right? That moral obligations flow from having a particular nature that is oriented towards certain ends, the realization of which marks our perfection, flourishing, eudaimonia, happiness, etc., whatever, right? And that if we want to flourish and be excellent, all these things, then we should follow the dictates of our nature because that marks out what is truly our good end. But as it happens, by nature, we all do want those things. So the conditional becomes categorical, and there's where, you know, moral obligations come in. But then Father Davis is like, well, none of that applies to God, right? God isn't a being of potency and act. He's not ordered towards any end beyond himself. God just is his own end. He's a being of all and only purely, you know, positive perfections. I don't know if Davy says that, but he's a being of pure act, right? So the whole idea of moral obligations, of having some finite nature ordered towards some end that it has not reached yet or actualized, like, these conditions just do not apply to God.
Right.
So that's what Father Davis means by God is not a moral agent. It's not a moral agent within a particular moral framework, which is assumed by the classical theist. Now, you might have an issue with that moral framework. You might have objections to it or whatever, but that's a different argument against the classical theistic paradigm. But if you're trying to argue that God has moral obligations internal to classical theism, and that's how you're going to run a problem of evil, then I think Father Davis has some serious considerations that are very hard for the skeptic to get by without begging the question or shifting to a different sort of argument. So what are we doing? Well, we're just showing that, again, internal to classical theism, there's another relevant consideration, which is this idea of metaphysical dependence or layers of reality, which ultimately puts a fog over the moral linking principles that would be needed to run a successful logical argument. So we're both taking advantage of resources internal to classical theism to block logical arguments from you. We're just doing it in different ways, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, would it be safe to say that, I think I've already said this, that for Davis, God is not a being like other beings. For you guys, I guess the point you're highlighting is that God is not a cause like other causes. So there's God's activity as an agent exists and happens from a transcendent layer of reality. I mean, am I on the right track?
Yeah, totally right. I think a lot of the issues with the problem of evil against classical theists wind up equivocating on cause, right?
That's because, right.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So if you're someone like me who thinks that Davis has articulated a very strong case, and for me it's because he's just following Aquinas, my reading of Aquinas, then given your paper, you have two good responses to the logical problem of evil. Davis, and which, like I said, rests on the nature of God, and your guys's, which rests on God as a transcendent cause.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. Well, to be clear, I think there's actually an abundance of riches for the theist, and not to be like immodest, but like, I actually think there's a number of, like, actually, you know, I think what Plantinga says is generally successful as a defense, right? Like, I don't hold to a metaphysic to Plantinga, but I think, like, his project, you know, is forceful. I also think, as I try to show in The Best Argument for God, that a classical theist, you know, and Eleanor Stump is a good example of this, actually can discharge the burden of a theodicy as well. But it's also right to say, well, here's why a classical theist doesn't have to do that either. Like, it's cool to show that a classical theist could do it. But I think it's considerations like these and Davis and others, I think a classical theist could probably pick up on certain strands of skeptical theism too, right?
Sure.
To show that, no, we don't have to discharge a theodicy because we're just not really under serious threat from these types of arguments to begin with. That makes sense.
I'm not sure that a classical theist who's following Aquinas particularly could take advantage of Plantinga's defense specifically. That was kind of the subject of my dissertation, which we will not talk about.
That's right. Yeah. So let me acknowledge that. Right. I think a lot of that is going to come down to how one thinks of, well, creaturely free will and God's universal causality.
That's right.
Right. And there's some there's some debate among classical theists in that regard. So depending where you land on that, you're definitely right. That will either make available something like Plantinga's defense or it will not. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, let's, if we could. Oh, Daniel, do you want to say something? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just want to say, underlying all of this with Thomistic metaphysics, I think, if I could be a little bold here, this isn't in the paper, but this idea that somehow God has moral properties that are contingent upon creation is very problematic for classical theism. So if you're going to say somehow God is affected by the sort of world he makes, I think you've already misconstrued the fundamental project of classical theism as it understands causality and God's relation to the world as not one of a real relation. Anyways.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Those are all relative points. So let's wrap this up with some objections, if we can. So you guys address, I think, the most important objections within the paper. So let's just quickly talk about a couple of them. You guys talk about the wholesomeness objection. What is the wholesomeness objection? How do we respond to it?
I guess I can take that one. So the basic idea might be an initial pushback when we talk about that first formulation of a vertical principle, and we bring in Tolkien, and we make the bold claim that you can't really infer these sorts of moral properties about Tolkien because he has orcs torturing people and killing and all these sorts of things going on. That doesn't mean he has those sort of orcish properties and he behaves like an orc and so forth. And one might say, well, you know, you read certain books and you do get a certain moral picture of the author, you know, and we bring up the example of George R. R. Martin, whose Game of Thrones or Song of Fire and Ice novel series is a morally ambiguous world with gratuitous sex and violence. And you get a sense that he might have a bit of a some moral issues going on in his mind, or he's trying to evoke those sorts of bloodlust or sexual lust in his readers, something like Marquis de Sade. If you're not open to impugning Martin, I think most people would agree that de Sade is pretty depraved. You can get that from reading his literature. But we are arguing that, once again, that issue, that inference, is really about authorship rather than world creating. In other words, they're an author causing feelings and imaginings in people around them. And they do that by attending to the world they create in certain ways. And so we actually point out Tolkien's world is just as horrific, if not more, than some of these other fictions that one could impugn the moral character of the author on. So, you know, Tolkien's world is pretty horrible in certain ways. And yet the issue isn't the existence of those evils. If you're going to make a moral inference about the author, it's the way they're kind of describing it, focusing on it.
The mode of attendance. And, yep. Effectual attendance, right. Stuff like that. Yep.
And so when it comes to God, the whole point is, well, God isn't really attending to a sort of novelization of creation in a way that focuses on the most gratuitous acts of evil. And so that sort of critique doesn't really apply. And again, it's not really capturing our point about the inference. It's sort of like within the world itself, the existence of those evils do not impugn the moral character of the one imagining or grounding that world.
Good. Pat, anything on that, or do you want to talk about more?
Yeah, just when you focus on some of the relevant features there that might enable that inference, like the mode of attendance, this is again where the classical theist has resources, such as, you know, God's mode of knowing, right, the world. Very, very different from us. So those sorts of, you know, seem relevant features, again, drop out when we're considering the particular case at hand. So yeah, we don't think that this ultimately goes through. And particularly the classical theist is fortified against it, right? And I want to be somewhat modest. Like, I don't want to say that other theists can't make use of some of these resources, don't have them available. I just want to say that definitely the classical theist is on very solid grounds against these sorts of attacks. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. All right. Let's talk about what you guys call moral collapse. If we can't infer the moral status of God from his creation, as you argue, doesn't this leave us in a state of skepticism when it comes to, let's say, first of all, morality per se, but then what about God's character? Are we completely in the dark about God's character? How do we respond to that?
Yeah, so we're kind of considering this objection from the skeptical theism literature and asking, does this apply to our case? So I'll just assume that your readers have at least a general familiarity with skeptical theism, and one of the objections that's brought against that is this would seem to land us in a situation of total moral skepticism, right? Like, we wouldn't know what the right thing to do would be in certain situations and whatnot. And this is a disastrous result because we shouldn't be in moral skepticism. So I want to say, on the most fundamental and practical level, which is our moral human concerns, this doesn't apply, right? Because we're on that horizontal level. For the classical theists, for the traditional essentialists, you know, moral obligations flow from our nature. We're quite familiar with that. So I want to say, yeah, there's no issue at all with what we're proposing in our argument and sort of everyday, you know, practical moral reasoning for us. There's no reason that should invite any sort of moral skepticism. The more interesting question or concern is whether it invites a sort of divine moral skepticism. Can we have any moral expectations of God? And in the paper, we kind of leave this as a something to think about point, right? You know, like, hey, this deserves further, you know, research. Is there a way to think about the moral nature of God that wouldn't be interrupted by or sort of cut off by the sorts of considerations we make in this paper? And Daniel and I, even though we don't say it in this paper, we certainly have some thoughts on it, right? So in one sense, I think our paper helps the theist to avoid making a sort of engaging in a sort of very bad project for trying to discern God's moral features. And that's a sort of project of collecting or counting goods in the world, right? Like, yeah. God must be good because look at how beautiful the waterfall is and the rainbow and all those stars and this and that. And the reason that's a bad project is like, man, it only takes like 5 seconds, not even that, to point out some seemingly equally grotesque horrors. So like, I don't think you want to get into this like counting game, right? So our argument definitely disrupts that sort of approach, and I think that's a positive. I think that's a benefit. However, it would not disrupt traditional metaphysical considerations for God's goodness. So if you're a kind of classical metaphysician, and you're kind of following Aristotle or Aquinas or Big Tent Platonism, and you've got your theory of the transcendentals, the convertibility of goodness and being, and you're working out the necessary conditions for things, and you get to God through, say, traditional cosmological reasoning, where you think God is the ultimate necessary condition for all the sorts of, contingent, finite, mutable, composite things in the world. You think God is purely actual, and you hold the theory of the transcendentals, and you're going to think God is purely good, analogically good. But there's a real basis there for really saying that God is truly and perfectly good and supreme, right? Now, that doesn't give you the conceptual equipment to make like highly precise predictions of exactly how God's going to like govern the world, that he'll never let me stub my toe or suffer greatly. Clearly God does let us suffer greatly, but it does give you a basis for that isn't interrupted by our argument against evil for saying that God is really good. And then beyond that, we also want to say that you could get a little bit more specific from divine revelation, right? If you think that God exists and you think that there's good reasons that God has revealed himself to the world, and you think there's good reasons that God would not lie, maybe you're a classical theist and you think God just is truth itself, there's some resources there. You at least have a warranted basis, we would argue, for taking what God has revealed as true, right, about himself and his justice and his mercy and his compassion. So those are two routes, I think, that you can legitimately get to a general assessment of God's goodness and moral character. But again, it's not going to be able to give you like hyper specific predictions about exactly how God's going to govern the world. How's that sound? Daniel, go ahead. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If I might add, and this thought I've been kind of chewing on, going back to that rule of restricted inference that Pat mentions, You'll note that one of the things that Pat said we could infer, if there's the Lord of the, if there's Middle Earth, there's Tolkien. In other words, you can infer existence, right? Now, if you have a sort of classical theistic Thomistic metaphysic and you understand the convertibility between being and goodness, then I can make a sort of inference from the goodness I observe in the world to the goodness of God. And then you might say, well, what about evil, right? I observe evil. Can I make the same move? And here I would go back to the fourth way. The reason you can sort of do this is because there's a sort of asymmetry between goodness and evil, such that maximal being exists. But if you start talking about trying to infer some sort of maximal evil God, like Stephen Law speculates in his Evil God Challenge, that doesn't work, because the gradation of goodness we see in this world, the privations, do not seem to require a grounding in some sort of maximally evil being, which Thomas writes about, I believe, in the Summa Contra Gentilis, as incoherent thought. The sort of maximal evil or perfect evil just doesn't make sense, because it sort of eats itself.
Doesn't make sense from the perspective of a classical theism for sure. Well, Daniel, Pat, thanks for being here and congratulations on a wonderful paper. I sincerely hope it gets the attention that it deserves.
Well, thank you, Anthony. We seriously appreciate the opportunity. And again, we can't cover everything, and there's much more to say about all the points. So I hope people read the paper because, yeah, it's kind of a tricky one to present just because it's just a bit different than what's the sorts of conversations usually had around the problem of evil. But again, thank you for having us.
Yeah, and thank you for the sharp questions. They're very, they cut to the point, right? So it was very nice. Thank you.
Tons of fun, guys. I will put the link to the paper in the description of this video.